Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Jody Kretzman, who will be speaking on Holden, community, and real world. So let's listen in on Jody Kretzman.
And this is a session that I hope will be a lot of open discussion that I call Holden and community and the real world. And I want to make a couple disclaimers. One is that I'm not under the illusion that Holden is not part of the real world. It seems clear to me that anybody who's been around for a while in this place understands that we all come up from someplace down the hill. And that down the hill we're involved in the real world continuously, and that we're up here to do, in fact, is to try to think about our lives together in a place apart where, in fact, some perspective might get gained. So this is, in fact, though a place apart, it is still very much the real world. We got a problem? What I think I'd like to do this afternoon is to make some opening remarks about this slippery topic of community, and then to very briefly put a couple of current cases before us, referring to some contemporary gurus, at least two contemporary gurus. Dan, you can sit up here. I'm not referring to you as a guru or Andrew. I want to refer us, first of all, to a group of people who have emerged over the last 3 or 4 years that we've had something to do with, called the communitarians, and they are represented by a book which came out last year by Amitai Etzioni, who's now a professor at George Washington University. And their argument is one that I want to just put on the table briefly as one of the cases to look at. And then the other piece of material that I want us to deal with in a sort of concrete way is the experience of the intentional community at Holden and what that's about and how that, in fact, might relate to our lives as we live them down the mountain. We've been talking this week in some of the sessions that many of you have been involved with me in about the power of communities to, in fact, rebuild cities. But it's clear that there's a cultural challenge that's before us that is one which something that's going on in late 20th, early 21st century advanced technological nations that has to do with a kind of yearning for whatever we mean by community. And I think that yearning is something that we probably all run into every day of our lives. And I find it to be one of the centrally fascinating questions about who we are and where we're going. True, about the motivation that sort of leads us into a yearning for community, and see whether they make sense to you. Our work in cities, in low-income neighborhoods in particular, has led us to rethink the power of communities as places which recognize the unique gifts and capacities of individuals, and which mobilize those gifts and which bring people together to solve problems. Lots of people ask when we talk about communities, what in the world do you mean by it? Just written a book called Building Communities from the Inside Out. And I don't think any place in that book we have succumbed to the temptation to answer that question, what do we mean by communities? But let me just say a word about it as we start our discussion this afternoon. It seems to me that communities can be thought of in a couple of just really quick and dirty ways. One is spatially. That is that we all live in some form of immediacy, relationships with other immediate people and family. then there's local community, whatever form that might take, neighborhood, and there's a, and there's often state or regional community, and there's a national community, there's some kind of a global community that people think about now. So that spatial community, particularly locality, continues to be important. Let me just make a side comment here. It seems to me that one of the reasons we work at the neighborhood level in cities so much, on a very local level, with little things happening in this inside circle, is because the people who are most tied to locality, who don't leave where they are, tend to be those people who are most vulnerable in society. That is, when I go to an airport, most of the people that I see when I have a suit on look like me. They're white guys. White guys with briefcases and suits and ties. People who don't go to airports mostly are women and poor people, people of color and children.
Unless they work there.
Unless they work there, that's right. Or unless they don't have a home and they live there, which is the case at O'Hare in Chicago. It is their neighborhood. So that one reason to concentrate on locality, on place, on the spatial dimension of community as continuously important, even while all this talk goes on about an increasingly mobile society. Even as Ted gets on and off planes and goes back and forth to Hungary and Romania and Latin America every week, right? Is that people, lots of folks, don't do that. And they tend to be trapped. Nonetheless, and therefore that's the locus for thinking about justice. That's the locus for thinking about how it is we take the most powerless segments of our society and do something that makes sense with them. But there's a cross-cutting way, obviously, of thinking about communities as well. That those of us who are experiencing the sort of mobility that characterizes late 20th century America are increasingly part of communities that define our relationships as non-spatial. Their work, their professions, their faith, their ideology, their commitments, their issues, a whole variety of ways that people draw together to relate to each other that are non-spatial. So I guess the simple suggestion I'm making here is that when we think about community, we might want to think about two ways to understand what we're saying. One is spatial, and one is not a whole series of non-spatial ways. But that there's something special about the most local spatial way, because that's the box, the circle, which contains the people with the least power in the culture. Now let me think for just a second with you about the power of community as an underutilized resource in late 20th century America, and therefore why holding is so important. And not just an escape. It seems to me that more and more our lives are experienced as living in a kind of two-dimensional world which contains two realities. One is us as individual people, each of us as individuals. And the other is huge institutions. And that somehow the relationship between us as individuals and these huge institutions, which we always represent as pyramids or as triangles, is what determines where we are in the experience, at least the material experience of life in late 20th century America. Somewhere in these huge institutions, we sometimes touch base with something that's more circular, that's less like one of these big pyramids. And these circles for me always represent community. What I want to think with you for just a minute about at the outset here is, what would it be like to rediscover a society, a way of living together, would somehow combine these huge institutions and a revivified, strengthened power of the circle of community? Let me try and make what I'm saying a little bit clearer here by being very simple-minded about it. Sometimes I think that there are two ways to be advanced industrial societies, that one is an institutional way of being and one is a community way of being. And I think it's helpful to think dichotomously for a moment about those two ways of being, because some of what I've begun to believe is that we all, at least those of us in this room, live with one foot in an institutional reality and one foot in a communal reality. But that most of what we think about is the foot that we have in the institutional reality. What I want to suggest is that one way of thinking about institutions and communities is to say that they're two tools for solving social problems, which are very different kinds of tools. They're like a hammer and a saw. They do different things, and they do it in different ways. The kinds of institutions we know, the big ones, the hierarchical ones, the bureaucratic ones, were mostly invented in the 19th century to do a particular kind of work. And the particular kind of work they were invented to do was to produce a whole lot of the same thing. Basically, what big institutions are good at is producing a whole lot of the same thing. Fords, or 707s, or seminary graduates, fifth graders, or social service treatments, doctors. Right. That's not what communities are good at. So this is a recent invention, these big institutions, these big corporations, these big government agencies, these big churches, that has replaced the power that we used to invest in community. And I want to just think with you about the contrasting ways of solving problems. And we'll get to Holt in a minute. Let me just play with this for a second. What's the contrasting style here? Obviously, big systems and institutions are hierarchical, top-down. Associations, which are the expressions of community, tend to be circular or flat or more democratic. These are formal. These tend to be informal. These are mostly about control, while these are about consent. These tend to be rigid. The edges here are straight, while these tend to be flexible. This is about order. This is about opportunity. This thrives on sameness. This on uniqueness. Participation in these big institutions is most often required for pay, for credit, for salvation. Where participation in communal structures is voluntary. In here, in these big institutions, people are more valuable the more anonymous and interchangeable they are. Here, people are more valuable the more unique, the more valuable they are. Big institutions think in categories, in aggregates. Communities tend to think about individuals and relationships. Values here tend to be objective. Values here tend to be subjective. The language of institutions tends to be neutral and quantitative and scientific, while the language of community tends to be committed, colorful, quirky, colloquial. Institutions tend to learn things by doing things like studies or surveys. Communities learn things by telling stories. And to tie it in with the themes we've been dealing with in terms of cities, institutions, many of them, get built on people's emptiness, clients to serve, customers to sell to, consumers to fill up, recipients to serve. Communities are always about bringing together the fullness of citizens, the gifts of the people of God. Well, you get the idea. The suggestion I want to make is that communities and their power have been squeezed out by institutions and their imperial role in our lives. I don't want to be heard here at the outset as being anti-institution. As a matter of fact, I value what institutions can give us. And Ted, you're probably with me when I say that when Ingrid and I get on a plane next Monday to fly back to Chicago, I want that plane to be a product of this, not of this.
I don't predictability.
Absolutely.
And institutions are good at
I don't want a community meeting in the cockpit. Which button shall we press? I want them to follow absolutely what the manual says. So there are clearly uses for the institutional way of being. The suggestion is, however, that we have become so enamored of this way of being, of this way of going at problems, of this way of, in fact, mediating our relationships with each other, that we've squeezed out this. I think people feel that all over the United States. I think that's what Robert Bella and his colleagues who wrote Habits of the Heart were writing about. I think that's a book that's about the search for this in a context where people have only experienced this. I think there's a hunger there. I think that when the church gets itself into legalistic arguments and starts citing scripture as proof text and begins thinking like lawyers, people who are looking to the church for this leave and go elsewhere where they can find some of this. Does that make sense? So to Holden. Holden has been trying this for all of its 34 years. What I think is clearer now than has ever been here is I think what was present at the beginning at Holden. Chuck, you've written the book and you can maybe check us on this. But I think there was a feeling in 1960 that this was about to happen, that we were about to get overwhelmed by a modern, technical, hierarchical, bureaucratic, huge set of systems, and that therefore a place apart was needed even more. I don't think people would have thought of Holden in anything like the same way in 1940, because ours is really the first generation which has not experienced community as an inherited thing, right? Like fish in water, where we just are growing into it. We know that if we're German or Norwegian or Lutheran of any stripe, we know what that means. It's clear to us. All of the ways of being are clear to us. Now, though, more and more, the challenge has become, how do you self-consciously and with all the wisdom we can possibly muster, recreate and empower this space? Just a word then about the cases. The Communitarians, the Spirit of Community is Etzioni's book, this is a sort of manifesto of the group that calls themselves the Communitarians, are one expression nationally in the United States of this set of impulses. Basically, the argument of this book, and it's certainly worth looking at, partly because it's about this set of impulses. What Etzioni and his colleagues are arguing here is that basically we have as a society not only become over-institutionalized, but we have become overly individualized. Right? And in fact, the only way we now know how to be be public with each other, is to somehow organize our discussion around individual rights. So that the discussion that takes up the public sphere is most often about rights, about claims, therefore, on the public. And what the communitarians are arguing here is that a society which is constantly talking about my right to this versus your right to that is a society that is quickly running out of the will to work together on problems. Mm-hmm. Because every time I claim a new right, I'm making a claim on the public. I'm saying, because I have this right, somebody needs to react. And it's never about, then, the connection of responsibility. So that probably the core argument, that's a moral argument at the core of the communitarian movement, has to do with rebalancing rights and responsibilities. How it is we think about ourselves, not only as people with rights, but also as people with responsibilities, and therefore raise children and families and build communities where those commitments to each other are central to who we are. Right? Etsy, I'm going to just a word or two more about what the communitarians are up to, and then if you want to talk some more about that, we can. They position themselves between what they argue on the one hand are the radical individualists, and on the other hand, the authoritarians. It's interesting, they put radical, in the radical individualist category, they put not only people like libertarians or people sort of on the conservative end of the Republican Party, but they also put the ACLU and a variety of clearly, in their view, extreme rights-oriented interpreters of the Constitution. And on the other end of the spectrum, they put the authoritarians, that those who would either impose morality, use the state in some way or other to enforce a kind of moral code. And they posit a middle way, and they say, there's a lot of space in here for us to redefine our relationships to each other, the way we resolve disputes, the way we redefine responsibilities. They want to expand mutuality. They want to revivify the commitments that are at the core of communities. That's a movement, I think, that's about partly imagining a politics built around some of the values of Poland. Not necessarily the religious values, but at least the public and civic values that Holden works out. My other text besides Etzioni today is Gertrude Lundholm, who's not here. Gertrude shared with us a little piece that she did for the board in her role as consultant to the Holden board, which is all of the things that Gertrude does was filled with wisdom. And she pointed to Holden as an exemplar of community because it holds up at the center two major themes that she thinks of as central to what community is. And both of them, I think, are absolutely right. And the two themes are voluntarism and hospitality. Features of community. The work in this sphere is seldom paid work. Real community is always about voluntarism. It's always about mobilizing the gifts of people, not some of them. Surprising gifts sometimes, Chuck. So Holden, when it's working well, is a place that welcomes and collects gifts and more or less organizes them. And to a great degree, people want to be here and they want to give. That doesn't happen here. And Holden then too is about hospitality. Holden struggles on the tightrope, which understands that communities always have walls and boundaries. It's the definition of a community to have walls and boundaries. But that
moral communities also always have welcome mats all over, windows in, that allow new folks to enter and to affect the place and to give their gifts. So that Holden is a place that struggles with the central dynamic of community building: meaningful walls and powerful welcome mats. That's what hospitality asks us to do. That's tough. Could point to other features of Holden. Lots to learn, much to take down the mountain. Clearly, the centrality of the faith commitment animates the people of the Holden community. Clearly, the importance of worship and ritual and celebration ties together the people in this community. We think about how much we do that every day and how little we do that, at least in my experience, in the rest of my life. Think about the way Holden flattens people's relationship to each other, democratizes it, takes away titles. Nobody knows who's a doctor, who's a lawyer, who's a janitor.
Who's ordained?
Who's ordained, who's not, who's a bishop. Discussion is much more democratic and therefore full of surprises, full of gifts. It's a conscious way, in fact, of saying this way of being, when you come up the mountain, gets left behind. Clearly, Holden is a place that exists by passing on its values through stories. Your book is filled with them, Chuck. And those are only the ones that could afford to see the light of day in print.
Yes.
A lot of the most important stories.
Some couldn't be put in the print.
A lot of the most important stories about Holden are ones that only get told late at night.
After a couple glasses of wine,
we hear again about a certain unnamed announcement maker at noon who managed to send everybody out to the bus with a good old Holden clap. Those are the legends out of which community get made. Almost all of the characteristics that I was thinking about, which contrast the community way of going at problem solving, are in some way part of the intentional experiment here at Holden. So that what we get to do when we come up the bus is to sort of step into not only a place apart, but I think a really well thought through, often messy, attempt to lead us through experience into a different way of being in late 20th century America. My question to myself constantly is, what is it about what goes up here that could inform more fully what my life is like in Chicago? These are not two separate worlds. And how is it not only that this could work better, all of the stuff that Holden is up to here, but how is it that it could be exported in ways that infuse our lives in parishes, in workplaces, in local neighborhoods, and in cities? What's to learn from this? What does it have to teach us? I don't think we can afford not to ask that question at a sort of conscious level. Because if we just absorb it as a nice experience and a place to encounter wonderful people for a while, it seems to me we're robbing it of some of its power, some of the power that it can have to reorient us in our lives. Back where we come from. I don't want to say any more now. I'm going to just open it up and see about lessons, community lessons in your life here at Holden and your life at home. What's different? What can be learned? What can be taken back? take this discussion any place you want to take it. Chuck, you've told this story over and over again. What would you
I wanted to stress one additional element, which I think fits into the picture you've drawn, and it is, in my experience of more than 60 years of living, very nearly unique. I can't think of another example of it. This place was a gift that was received by its receivers as a place, as a facility, as a locale, before anybody had thought anything about a plan for using it, or a program, or what to do with it. And I think that's part of the distinctiveness of Holden that we're still trying to figure out. What is it that we should do with this place? I remember the people who were key to the reception of it in 1960. Yeah. They were the youth staffs of the three, at that time, three major U.S. Lutheran bodies. And they said, we can't refuse to take it, but what the devil are we going to do with it?
Right.
And the best they could come up with initially was to use it as a youth center, a young adult center. It didn't become that. After a year or so, that was abandoned, and it became intergenerational. But I think it has become what it is with all of its openness because it began completely open. Hmm. Usually what we do in the church and in the general society as well, I guess, is somebody comes up with a program or a plan or a strategy for doing something and then builds a factory or builds a university or builds a facility or how to house it or an office. It was exactly the opposite here, and that almost never happens.
That's interesting.
We just inherited a place that we knew we had to do something with, but what do we do with it? Mm-hmm. And I think that question is still being raised. What do we do with this place? Mm-hmm. And it's still open. Mm-hmm. So there aren't any straight edges on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a circle that is very open to whoever's here this week.
Exactly.
Decides what to do with it.
Yeah.
Really?
That seems right to me.
And we don't have that luxury in the real world very often, I don't think. We usually have givens.
And the extreme given, obviously, is the institutional way of being. I mean, an institution, you know, Max Weber taught us, an institution is based on bureaucracy. It's basically a collection of empty slots, right? It doesn't need people. It's a structure that's there, and you can put anybody into those slots. Doesn't matter whether it's Carol Hinderly or Chuck Lutz.
Right? And the definition of bureaucracy usually is to maintain itself, to continue doing what it does,
it's
needed any longer or not.
Right. Exactly.
That's the definition of bureaucracy.
Absolutely. Just why they're so hard to
protect itself.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. What about lessons? Yeah.
One of the other things I think about is when you mentioned that flattening quality for everyone, it also does that for individual families. I mean, this is a family place. But your family comes and you have these youngsters and they have a kind of freedom to be with other people, other adults. They don't have to sit with you at meals. And I mean, the very first time that we were here and I came to Vespers and Jonathan, who was 12, was leading Vespers, and I didn't know he was.
He didn't get permission.
I didn't know he was even friends with the person that had sort of decided together with him to do it.
But that's interesting.
That all this kind of strength of becoming who you are in a community where people care and are interested, and you can pull back into your small family unit whenever you either ask yourself as a family to do that, or when the need is there. But otherwise, you know, lots of families return year after year because you know, they can go backpacking and not have to go with mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And something magic happens that you can't even tell.
That's really interesting, yeah. I mean, I think sometimes the families in the real world out here that are in the middle of institutions get to be sort of fortress families, right? In order to keep it together, you really have to sort of put the walls up around, you got to make the rules, you got to, you know, and it's important to do that.
Well, in lots of the institutions, the family isn't really part of it. It's
right.
Age or nerve.
That's right, but if you're wedged in between a bunch of these institutions, the family is under attack all the time, right?
Yeah.
But here it becomes permeable. There's space, there's air that gets into it. Yes.
Right. Well, another sense about that leveling quality is that, you know, I find really refreshing is that, you know, no matter who you are, except, you know, if you're on staff, be it director or teaching staff or whatever, you know, there's no elevated, no position so elevated that you don't have to do garbology.
That's right.
Or dish team.
Or a dish team. Yes. And so, you know, everybody has to do the grunt work, which is just totally different from out there where, you know, we hire people to do the grunt work,
yeah.
where a measure of status is how much you don't have to get your hands dirty.
It also may serve to elevate that work beyond the level of grunt work.
Yeah.
So that you can sort of reevaluate what it means to have clean dishes for 500 people for the next meal,
mm-hmm.
and how it is we in fact take care of all the waste we produce.
Yeah, yeah.
While Holden is place-based, it has for a long time seemed to me to have many of the same characteristics of a movement, in that it's about, much of it is about ideas or progressive mess of one sort or another. Do you think that there's some relationship in that kind of quality of a movement to the left-hand community model, that, you know, neighborhood or something else?
Movements, it seems to me, are one way of understanding how it is communities which are working on similar sets of values express themselves in a larger public sphere. If you think about what do institutions do when they want to express themselves, it's something more like a campaign. I mean, it's something that's more structured, rational, step by step. But I think you're right, Anne. There's something that's about sort of lifting up community-held values into a wider public sphere that's more like, more messy, like a movement is, right?
So maybe that's kind of what we do when we leave here. I don't know.
Connecting with other circles, maybe? Connecting with other sort of impulses that somehow have overlapping values? One community, it seems to me, doesn't make a movement, right? One needs to connect across communities in a variety of ways. To put together something that could begin to be called a movement. I mean, the civil rights movement was the result of the impulses of a whole lot of community experiences across the South. Right? It got writ large. You know, one of the things that makes me think about is how could Holden be more self-conscious about relating to a variety of community impulses that share values across the United States? Is there something that could be done that is more intentional around movement building? Yeah.
For those of us in our work life work in big institutions, one of the challenges is there any way to create more of a community behavior in institutions? Some corporations in this country have experimented with it.
Yes.
Cortex, Nike in its early days, Apple in its early days. It seems to me, as I watch the literature, as they get bigger, they inevitably become more and more rigid and hierarchical. And is it possible to move community behaviors into institutions? Is the pace of information, and as you say, when you get on the airplane, you want to be darn sure that the engine works and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to a hospital, you want to make darn sure that people know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, clearly, I mean, across the globe, there is a whole series of efforts to take these big, steep triangles and make them at least look more like that, you know,
yeah.
Flatter, right? And drive decision-making down to where people are actually making decisions, who are doing the work. I mean, that's what Deming was about in Japan. And I think that's probably what Clinton and Gore mean by reinventing government, right? So the question partly is, how much of this space at the base of big institutions can be community space, can feel like it's this. And certainly some of it probably can, but I think there are probably some limits too to how much it can. You know, it also makes me think that there are probably some clear scale limits to what we're talking about over here. That
there's something about community which has at its core a capacity to encounter each other face-to-face and three-dimensionally, and to know the names. And probably 500 people in June and July and August in Holden Village is about the limit. Particularly if folks only stay.
So we shouldn't build more lodges.
Maybe not more lodges, but maybe more Holden Villages.
I thought that one of the things that inhibits us in this culture from good community is ownership of property and goods. You know, the ideal for much of our culture seems to be to get our little place, you know, as far away from the center as possible, and build our house and have our own washing machine and our own vacuum and our own lawnmower. And very little is shared with others, even those we live near. And the thing that's remarkable for me and the contrast whenever I go back home from Holden is that here we share space, we share work, we share meals, we share all sorts of things with others. And back home, most of us live in these little fortresses. And we all want to have our own thing instead of sharing these gifts.
And then we have a lake place too.
Yeah.
Many of us to get away from still further.
That's right. Yeah. This is a place that reminds us that we could get along a lot less than we do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, you see, there's a model of contrasting kinds of things of villages, like in Alaska, where you see communities breaking apart rather than coming together, and you see individuals who have now become disenfranchised. The biggest thing, for instance, in some of the villages was television. They no longer would socialize in groups with festivals and other things. They would stay back in their homes. The drinking increased. It was an awful thing to happen, actually, in some way, as you saw a community deteriorate right in front of your eyes when people no longer had these kinds of things occurring. And we can see a model here of destruction rather than building. Individuals in the communities now feel themselves as deprived. They see all these things on television rather than feeling empowered, their abilities to survive. I'm most familiar with a village called Barrow, where individuals were able to survive for thousands of years in a very cold, inhospitable climate, and being able to live and enjoy life there, and yet somehow they feel deprived now that they're not capable of doing certain kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you see a destruction. This whole issue of ownership, you know, land was considered not to be owned but communal. We never closed our, we never locked your doors in the villages when I was up there, because people had to come in order to get out of the cold. I mean, that was a hospitable and traditional, because you never wanted to find anybody at your doorstep frozen to death, right? So that was, your door was always open, and you were obligated to do that. Food was shared with people. You know, you have a lot of leftovers when you catch a whale, right? I mean, so that's shared among the community, right? I mean, you were forced to do those kinds of things. So when they caught a whale, they were able to share this, and the older folks got it first, which was real interesting. And it was an important kind of communal kind of idea to drop off meat and resources at the older people who couldn't do that, who didn't have other means of doing it, and then to have a feast for the village. Actually, it was a shared kind of thing, which you can see the deterioration of the community in some of the villages.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's the picture here. That's the massive institutions, including communications institutions, that have just targeted individuals as consumers of both information and goods, and put us in our living rooms behind closed doors.
Absolutely.
That's why this isn't out there.
I think what you has brought up a very important point to me, that we need to look at about successes of communities. And I'm thinking of the contrast, I'd like to hear more about yours sometime, as to this, where your people, or the people that you were with, were there permanently, and the people in this community can do without, the people that come here can do without, because they know they're going to go back eventually. Maybe it's a long-term staff, 2 years, so forth, and of course television. And I think that, I think you hear what I'm saying, that there's a whole, if we all stayed here forever, what would happen? Would the fact that we're community and not institution, would it do the same as the communities I'm hearing here? Could we live forever without all the stuff that we're used to? And many of the people in your community never had those things. Now when it's introduced, community is disappearing.
Well, this same location and facility once was an institution, and I suspect very much like the one on the right, because it was
this is the mine.
It was here to do one thing, to extract ore and make money from it.
And the end was not made, the decision was not made by the community.
Absolutely.
No.
Sprung on it by the institution.
Overnight. Probably made in another place.
But what is exportable? What is it? Is there anything up here, or do we just have to come back up here? Barbara?
Well, my experience every time I leave Holden Village is it's so wonderful on the boat, you're visiting with everybody, and then you drive home, and you go to church next Sunday, and you hug everybody like you've been spending 2 weeks doing here. And they all look at you like you're crazy. And they won't, you know, they don't, you know, they'll sort of hug you back, but it's like, you know, you just come back from Mars or something. And I would like to export that, but it's mutual. You can't get everybody to be hugging you back.
Yeah, there's something about community that is at its core mutual. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not something one imposes on.
Unless you have a critical mass of huggers.
That's right. Are there a half
dozen experience? How many does it take?
I've been here, but it is so different. There's such a joy and loving, and that you're bonding with people you're only going to know for 2 weeks. You might keep writing, but you go back to your own church. You just don't.
Right. It's very
different. The press is doing that, and public opinion. Don't get too intimate. Don't stay away from people. Sexual harassment, all that business. So they're getting. You don't read much about Leo Bascalia anymore. I mean, he's sort of passe. He was not very popular. But now, I mean, the people are afraid to get anything.
Yeah, but Lutherans were generally like that before. The
You know, didn't have a whole lot of effect on them. Ted.
My experience is primarily in community building in third world countries, but my observation is that the more you try to package it, the more you will move over into this cookie cutter kind of thing, and that may be the greatest danger you face.
Yeah. I think the smartest writing about community, from my point of view, always emphasizes the surprising and sort of almost tangential nature of community. That community is something that happens when you're doing something else. It's not something that you work at as your central task. It is a gift when you're doing something else, if you're worshiping or if you're doing a task together or if you're part of a advancing a set of ideas. Or the community is a gift that happens when you work or when you're somehow advancing something else.
Kind of like friendship.
Kind of like that,
And you know, for me, one of the key element about the Holden community is that at base it's a faith community, and you know, it's like Barb made the comment the other day that at Holden you can be out of the closet with your spirituality, which.
Every day you can talk about your spirituality.
Yeah, you know, you can generally feel somewhat comfortable walking up to a stranger and, you know, mentioning that you're a Christian. You know, that's fairly safe. Yeah. Fairly. Not totally, but fairly.
We heard this morning that it's fairly safe to say that you're not.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, like, we have a group of people, 21 people here that we know.
Oh,
Okay, so...
You came together, you mean?
That's right. In some way, we all are connected with each other. We're going to go back to Anchorage. There are people here who haven't been to Anchorage, but at least we've all shared an experience together that we all are feel that we know. And that becomes then a nidus for growing other kinds of things. At least we know somebody who's been here and has experienced that. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a very important community kind of building where you can export this back to another place. Aha, you know how I feel, you know what I'm doing, and you can begin that community building. So
yes.
It's a very important kind of thing that you share this kind of experience.
Yeah. Yes, Carol.
I think, too, that one of the things that we can bring from Holden is hope. I think, like your thing yesterday about hope in the cities, I always think when we get through with Holden, we have a hope again for a community outside this place, and that hope is something we can share.
The typical first question when we meet a stranger is, what's your name? And the typical second question is, what do you do?
What do you do? Yeah.
And it strikes me that from your talking this week about communities and gifts of people, but that's the wrong second question. A different question would be, what can you give? But we label people so quickly, what you do is what you are, that it becomes, in many ways, I think, a barrier to ever working together. As soon as people hear, I'm such and such, then they immediately label either they're a different social class, or they're a different type of person, or they wouldn't like me because they're professional group or
housewives. I've known that for a long time.
It's possible that the question, what are your gifts, is a community question, and the question, what do you do, in the way we ask it, is an institution question, right? So we're asking the wrong kind of question if we're interested in community building. If we ask somebody first, what do you do? The question that's sort of over here.
Well, I was going to say that I'm a long-term staff here at Holden, and I've been here for 1 year. I'm the nurse. And I learned during the winter community, I came here last April, not really ever thinking about community. I came here to do something different as far as a nurse, and I never really lived in a small town. I lived in a large city all my life. And so it was kind of hard for me to have all this affirmation,
You can never be anonymous. Never be anonymous.
Get out of my face with your affirmation.
I'm just telling you how I feel.
That's great. Yeah.
And there is this really positive affirmation, acceptance, and sometimes more than I want. And also in the winter community, to be able to learn how to live together and really close. For some of us, it's not always real easy. And to share in keeping this village going. You know, learning how to stoke the furnaces, clean the furnaces, you know, run the Hobart with no power. It really brought us really close. And then now with the, you know, it's kind of been a little bit of an adjustment because I was gone for 3 weeks and I just came back, and it feels like, wow. But I think it's what I would say is that many of us in the small community get a chance to try and do things that we wouldn't necessarily have an opportunity to do in other places in our lives.
Should churches be community? Isn't that the model that we should be looking at? Or one of the things, so, you know, I mean, I come from a small area in Anchorage where churches are small. I mean, like, maybe if you go back to Minnesota where there's thousands of people in a church, they have cells, you know, and I think you form community in those kinds of bigger churches in different kinds of ways than we would. We could probably, you know, the thing that split us up in Anchorage the most is two services. You know, it blew us apart. We never saw those people anymore, and it just blew us apart that we had two services. And It was devastating for us. We could, it took us a long time to recover from that. Then we started a community of first service people, rather than second service people. But you could feel that kind of thing as we started to do that.
It goes to both services now.
You don't have to, So I mean, but it seems like the true church. It should be the model of community in some way, in some form or the other.
And in whatever the necessary institutionalization is, ought to be in service of the community nature of the church, rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it seems to me where we get in trouble in the church. I mean, if you think about something like the sexuality statement, the ELCA, that is a sort of necessary institutional gesture at this point, probably. But it's busting up community, and we haven't figured out a way within the church to have community happen around discussions of sexuality. We sort of know how to produce something that comes steaming out of the institution, but we don't know what to do with it in terms of community.
When you ask what we can bring out, two of the main things are what Gertrude talked about, hospitality and volunteerism in our churches, I'm thinking especially.
Yes.
And they kind of go together. You talked about all the welcome mats.
Yes.
Our churches can have a circle with kind of a wall of those of us that know each other. And you need all these welcome mats and sometimes providing a lot of opportunity for letting people's gifts be used.
Yes.
At least to my experience, you ask somebody to help with something specific, instantly makes them feel welcome. That's a hospitable thing to do.
Absolutely.
But you have to be careful. There are people in some of the churches that don't want to be asked to do anything. If they're asked, they don't come back again. I mean, they want to go to the service, and it's over, they want to leave. What I mean to do with any volunteer work? You have to be careful of people, too. You can't expect everybody to do things. So some of them present it. They don't want to do anything. They want to go, say their prayers, leave. That's it.
But the work is forced over here in the institutions. These are places that ask for gifts, and gifts are willingly given.
One better plate, get out of it.
Right.
But it's kind of a halfway answer. I think the biggest thing that I've learned is that you give people the opportunity to say no.
Absolutely. Sure.
We say no too much for them.
Sure.
We need to give them the opportunity.
Some of them don't even like to be asked.
Well, that's their problem and not yours.
It's an interesting point. I mean, it could be that one of the central functions of communities is, in fact, hospitality. And it's opening the windows and making absolutely clear that everybody's gift is welcome, and we'll find a way to get it given. And the broader the definition of who's included on that welcome mat, right, the more it is we get plugged into the kind of diversity that
a lot of churches have coffee hours after the services.
Right.
And they usually are asked, so won't you come to the coffee hour? Some people say to themselves, I don't want to go to coffee hour, sit around, small talk. I ruin my breakfast. If I have coffee, I want to get out of here. So, even inviting people to coffee hour sometimes is
you don't want to force them to go.
Something that presents the
right.
Even being asked.
Absolutely. Thank
you. This makes Holden sound pretty idyllic, and we all know that Holden has bones in its structure. It has hierarchy, it has structure, it has management, some good management, some not so good management in any given year. What's the role of good management in the circle?
Yeah, it's a good question. Mm-hmm. This isn't just chaos over here in community. These are people who are organizing interactions in a variety of ways. That's a wonderful question.
And the circle has leaders.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who are recognized as such.
Yep. Yeah.
See, I get afraid when you just say, let hospitality be, the main focus. My experience is, if you are doing something, as several people mentioned, if you're working together on a project, you can have community as a side benefit, an extra byproduct. But if you set out to have it, it's kind of like sticking a gun in somebody's face and saying, be my friend.
Yes.
That's right.
But isn't that the definition of happiness? Do people want to go for happiness, but it's only on the side once you have another kind of goal, okay? And you don't, you try to go for happiness, you don't find happiness in the sense of happiness in that way. It's always a byproduct of something else. And it has to be a focused goal. You know, people come to you and ask you, well, I just want to be happy. Well, that is not, you are not going to do that.
Yeah.
You need to, we need to get you going. And what is it, what's meaningful? Yeah, don't worry, mental health. What is mental health when you don't have any goals? You know, nothing, you know? Mental health, just sitting there, and mental health is not there. I'm
right.
Sorry. Yeah. So you, and that's what's so important.
Yeah.